Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for December 16th, 2021, and one of the last shows of the year. Good grief. Where did this year go? What a crazy year. What a crazy year. This will go down in history as one of the craziest years on record, but is that possible? I think every year has been crazy. Maybe it would be hard to pick a year that's the craziest, but this one certainly ranks up there, mainly because we're living in it right now. Bottom line is we got to get rid of these world controllers. That's the whole issue. And, you know, people say, oh, Bill Gates and things. No, Bill Gates is just a nobody. If you see their name, if you read about them in the newspaper, they're not the top dog. They're just a nobody clogging the wheel out there. Could be eliminated in a New York second by the people that are above them. You never see the names or will see the faces of the people really controlling this planet. Okay, so anyway, enough of that. But in the ongoing series, I thought I ended my Electric Highways to the Star presentation back at the end of November. I said, okay, that's it. We're going to wrap it up. But then all of a sudden, this comet, Leonard, designation C2021A1 Leonard, shows up, and it's like, wait a minute, wow, this is big, big time. For example, when I started out the lecture series on Electric Highways to the Stars back in August, this is with my show. Remember that I gave a video. I have a video in my video series of the hard videos that I sell, the discs, and send out. It's called Electric Highways to the Stars. It's a talk I gave in 2003 at the UFO International UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada. And, of course, this was the title that I chose because of riding electric currents with electromagnetic propulsion systems. But let me digress for just a minute here to let you know exactly what's going on tonight. Right now, I am on the way to a place where I should be able to observe the comet tonight. This is Comet Leonard. It's within 9 million miles of Venus at this point and approaching very quickly. And so at a point where I start to make observations, then I may cut in and change this narrative, which is a planned narrative discussion of this, to actually start reporting on the visuals of the comet. And I got reports a couple nights ago already that the comet was naked eye visible to people around the United States. So I was getting reports in that, yeah, people are seeing it with the naked eye, without binoculars, without telescopes, and that's a big event. Now, I want to reiterate that this is a major event in astronomical history. The last time the human race saw a comet come close to a planet was when Venus, the comet, came close to Mars back in probably around 2000 BC when this actually happened. And then they witnessed it come by Earth. Now, here is the big issue. Here is the crux of the issue. And that is that the passing comet can have a tremendous effect on the planet, as it did on planet Earth when Venus came by. And so that's a physical event where the comet comes by, affects a planet, people see it from Earth, and all of the physical effects. But the bigger effect, in my way of viewing this, is not just some comet coming by a planet and we see the planet going comet, turning into a comet at the same time, etc. All of the details that on my last two or three shows I've actually been describing in detail. But the bigger thing is that this is something that is feared incredibly. Tremendous amount of science, all of the fakery at NASA, all of the Carl Sagan, decades and decades of promoting his Cosmos series of Neil deGrasse Tyson, taking over and redoing the Cosmos series to put it out there to keep the public, to keep you stupid about outer space. All of their efforts could potentially go under when the world wakes up and sees the interaction of a comet with a planet. And so what happens then is that the leaders of the world lose power. And, you know, what happens in the next day or so, and what's going on right now with the comet and planet Venus, is one thing, but the silence in the press is, as they say, deafening. Because let me explain a little bit about the orbit of this comet. It's coming in from a great distance, and its closest approach to the sun is not going to be for a number of days until after it leaves connection with the planet Venus, which is actually tomorrow night, the 17th, is when the closest approach happens. So make sure you get the family out. Look up in the western sky. It would behoove you, if it's cloudy where you're at, look on the weather map, find a place where it's nice and sunny, maybe out in the country, and get out there and take a look at this thing, because this is something that has not happened literally for, well, 2000 BC. So that's about 4,000 years ago is the last time the human race has seen a comet come this close to a planet. And for the news media, the science news media, to not even mention it is, like I say, the silence is deafening. And that's an expression you use when you realize that they do not want you, the public, to see this. Now, I've talked to astronomers even who said, oh, no, that comet, Leonard, that's just a morning comet, and you won't be able to see it. I'm like, wait a minute. What do you mean that's a morning comet? That's the bulk of its orbit that we're going to see from the entire world, from the north and southern hemisphere, which is, again, unusual. And the timing of this, just before Christmas, just literally a week before Christmas, is astounding. This is incredible timing. And now that the comet is naked eye visible, and tonight you will see it closer to Venus, and tomorrow night at this same time, and a little later, this comet will be nose-to-nose. Actually, the actual time of closest approach tomorrow night will be 9 p.m. Central Time or 2 a.m. Universal Time is the time. So you can translate forever wherever you are in the world. But as the sun goes down wherever you are in the world, this comet will be the closest approach to Venus of any comet coming near a planet. So it's a major comet coming near a major planet. And as I said, this has not happened for 4,000 years. An absolute immense major astronomical event. And the newspapers are silent. The science newspapers or the science online like space.com and all of the other ones are just silent. Wait a minute, boys and girls, this is a major, major, major event. And to not publicize it at all to the point where even astronomers don't know about it. That's how well they have kept this a secret, if you can even imagine that. Okay, so as I approach the region in which I'm going to have a physical presence and an ability to see the comet myself, and it's because my normal area is cloud covered tonight. And so that's why I have to do this show and presenting this material to you now. And at some point, potentially change the topic once I get visual on the comet myself. And we have people around the country and around, hopefully, in other parts of the world who are doing very good amateur astronomical work on this, and I guarantee you there are other professional telescopes, etc., that are tuned in on this, that are pointed towards this comet-Venus interaction to take all the data possible in the ultraviolet, in infrared, in X-rays, all of these different wavelengths to get the data from this comet-planet interaction. But they're keeping this from you, the public. Okay, so there's a whole laundry list of topics here that I want to cover, and I would say this would be the equivalent of one of the rarest astronomical events in history, is to see a comet come this close to a major planet. Okay, so let me go through these, and this will be kind of out of order because I have these notes circled on my notes page here. Is the moon a factor? Now, here's what typically happens when you have a comet. It's only there for a few nights. It's only visible for a short period of time. And what happens is the moon is a lot of times a factor in that it's very bright. It blocks out the view of the heavens, etc. But what is going on right now is that the moon is back behind us. And when you're looking at the west, the moon is in the east. And so here is what's going to happen. Now, the prime time for when I think the actual events are going to happen between the comet and Venus are after the 17th, tomorrow night, when the comet starts pulling away, so on the 18th, etc. But the 18th is the full moon, and typically this would be a game changer, which it's not the best conditions. But all you can say is that the viewing is in the west, and the full moon is in the east, completely opposite, and the rising. So the full moon will affect viewing to a certain degree. But if you're in a very dry area, and out in the country, away from city lights, etc., you should have a pretty good chance at viewing the comet. At viewing the comet. With the naked eye, etc. And anybody that, say, has an elevation, or if you're up in the mountains and you have dry air, it's wintertime, you know, the air is dry, you should have very good viewing conditions. You should be able to see the comet very well, and especially if someone has a telescope. Okay, so the original question, is the moon a factor? Yes, it's a slight factor, but it could be worse. It could be, if the moon were in the western sky, it'd be all over. You wouldn't see anything. The moon would just dominate the sky. And then as the comet pulls away on succeeding nights, the moon, right at sunset, will be down below the horizon. So as soon as the sun goes down, it gets dark pretty quickly. It's wintertime, in the northern hemisphere at least. And of course, our friends in the southern hemisphere will have a good view also. But the sun goes down very quickly in the northern hemisphere. So right after sunset is where you're going to want to look, especially after the 18th. And even the full moon on the horizon, it doesn't contribute that much to the western sky in terms of light pollution. And so it's not the best, but it's not terrible. Let's just put it that way. Okay. And once again, just reminding you, do not look at the sun with your eyes. Do not look at the sun through binoculars or any kind of eyepiece, or do not look at the sun through telescope or any other types of optics, etc. And here again, I want to just mention that it's very interesting that we have a linear alignment, visual alignment, not electrical alignment, with the sun, but Jupiter, Saturn are up in the night sky right above Venus, but they're not contributing to any kind of electrical connection. Now, I want to mention this. If you were, say you were a resident of Venus, say Venus was an Earth-like planet, which it's not, of course, but say it was, and this comet was coming within 10 lunar distances of Earth, and you were a spacefaring society, and you understood about the electric highways to the stars and the electromagnetic propulsion systems to ride the electric currents off through the planetary system and off to another star. Now would be a prime time to leave Venus and ride the electric currents of this comet out into the solar system, or literally back into the sun also, if you happen to want to head into the sun. But most people would be going. And if you were an extra solar system entity, you could come down and ride the electric current down the comet tail and break, coming into, break meaning slow down, coming into Venus. And so this is the whole point of electric highways to the stars. And as I said before, it's very interesting to note that, let me use an analogy. Let's go back to the old sailing ships. where they had a sail. They had a sail up, and they would ride the winds. And the old square riggers especially, they did not go well into the winds. So they had to go with the winds. That's why they called them the trade winds. So when they came from Europe to the New World, that they would sail south along the coast of Africa, pick up the trade winds and come west, pick up their goods, etc. And then when they were going back to Europe, they would sail north, and then they would pick up the trade winds, which were the northern latitude trade winds going back to Europe. And they would ride them, ride the winds that were there. They were called the trade winds. So they'd come on one set of winds and go back on the other. Okay, well, anyway, when you're doing this in outer space, it's a little bit different. There's an added contribution here, which nature has put there. The designer of the universe has given us this wonderful gift for transporting ourselves around the solar system and around the galaxy. And these are the electric currents. But here's what happens. Imagine in the sailing ship situation, imagine just by putting the sailing ship out in the middle of the ocean, all of the winds concentrated on your sails. Wouldn't that be nice? Most sailors would love that. And then you'd get, even in a calm day, you'd have beautiful wind. You'd have as much wind as you wanted. But that is what happens in the electric version of this. And now you're not being pushed by the electric currents. This is not a solar sail. But anyway, that's a diversion from this entire topic about Comet Leonard. But the point is that when there's a comet like this that's in the solar system, it doesn't have to come necessarily close to a planet, but this is kind of like bringing the highway to you, so to speak. And back to the other point I was making about the sailing ships, what if the sailing ship, by just simply getting out into the wind, all of a sudden the wind concentrated on that sailing ship? But that's what happens. That does not happen with the sailing ship. It does happen with the electric currents. It's called the pinch effect. And what happens as the object gets into the current increases. It draws the current tighter into a tighter bundle and makes the propulsion system much more effective. So it's something that the designer... Now, this is one thing when, you know, I'll be honest with you, there are... not many physicists in the world who really have a good handle on this concept, and it's something I invented. I brought this out of nowhere. It did not exist before I brought it into existence. But the physics of it there, of course, were there by the designer. It's something we simply had to discover. But once again, the comet, after becoming an evening comet, is on its way into the solar system and becoming brighter and bigger. Okay, now, in a space.com article, they mentioned four comets, and they talked about something called forward scattering, which they believe was the cause of comets becoming brighter, and they mentioned four comets. So what I did is I said, let's go take a look at these four comets that throughout history, the last 100 years, have brightened unexpectedly. And I will also mention Comet Holmes, which I did a complete study on and a prediction when it had an electrical alignment with Mars. I believe it was Mars and Earth. I'd have to check that. But it's on my webpage. It's the discussion of Comet Holmes and how it just grew into this amazingly huge comet overnight, bigger than the full moon. And even though it was out by the orbit of Mars, amazingly enough. But anyway, I predicted that and on the date of which it happened because I knew of the electrical alignment. So anyway, what I did is I took these four comets that were stated to have been brightened because of forward scattering. And this is a condition where they think that because of its physical alignment with Earth and because of sunlight scattering on the material in the tail of a comet, that this somehow caused it to brighten. And lo and behold, I found with all four of these, there were physical connections electrically with the planets. And so I'm not going to go through the whole gamut of all of these because it gets rather detailed. But the point is that astronomers don't know what to look for. So they make up these bogus excuses regarding what they think happened, forward scattering, when reality is that it had an electrical connection with a planet on that given day when the brightening occurred. So here we go, space.com article in talking about Comet Leonard said that there were four comets that had this forward brightening thing, and they were thinking that maybe that would happen when the comet crossed the Earth-Sun line. It's already done that, and there was no amazing brightening there, but the reality is what we're looking at here is the connection that's going to come up tomorrow night with Venus. But I'll take this first comet of the four that they mentioned. It's called C1927X1, and I know I'm not going to say these names right, Chelyarup and Maristany. And so anyway, the designation is C1927X1. And so I went into the ephemeris of this comet, and I put it into an astronomical simulator, and here is what I found out. And like the explanation of Comet Aaron Rowland, they did not have access to my work, and they did not even know about the solar wind, 1927, when this comet came through the solar system. By the way, it had a sodium yellow tail, whereas Comet Leonard, which is up in the sky now, is green, indicating carbon dioxide, which would make sense because it's approaching Venus, which has a high carbon dioxide content in its atmosphere already there. Okay, so anyway, this comet then on December 15th, UTC 900, so universal time, on the 15th of December, which is interesting because that was 1927, but yesterday, but in 1927, it crosses the ecliptic 0.2 astronomical units from the sun. And get this, it does so exactly when Earth is perfectly aligned with this spot in outer space and the sun. So this is a perfect electrical connection between this comet and planet Earth. And what happens is that the comet becomes so bright. This is the midday sun. It becomes so bright that the people can see it in the daylight, midday. They can see this up in the sky next to the sun. That's how bright this comet is. And we're worried about seeing some comets in the middle of the night, just barely visible. This comet exploded into brightness so much that people literally saw it in the middle of the day right next to the sun. And this is due to an Earth Sun crossing event where it became electrically connected with planet Earth. But now here's the punchline. The astronomical community doesn't know why this is going on. Why is there a comet next to the sun that's so bright that it's in the middle of the daytime? So they say, oh, this is due to forward scattering. And that explanation sticks until today, literally almost 100 years later. And you wonder what's wrong with the astronomical community, boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas. Excuse me for just guffawing over this. It is so absurd to believe that forward scattering is the cause of this comet brightening to this degree. Okay, on to the next one. We have a comet West. It's comet C1975V1A. And that's because it was rediscovered, recataloged a couple times. But this was the final designation. It's sometimes called Comet 1976 West because its perihelion, its closest approach to the sun, was in 1976, although it was discovered in 75. And sometimes it's called the Great Comet of 1976, Comet West. So at any rate, here we go again. Look at this one on February 5th, and this is 2000 and, let me see. No, I'm sorry, back in it's on February 5th of 1976. So it's discovered in 1975, 1976 in February, 5th is the time, 1800 UTC, which puts it back around 1 in the afternoon central time. Now, this is a daytime comet once again. It's a daytime bright comet. And it flares exactly as it crosses the ecliptic. It has a perfect Mars and Saturn electrical alignment. So this baby is crossing the entire solar system from Mars to Saturn. It's got that big a connection. And it only takes a few hours to cross the ecliptic, in other words, the plane of the planets. So this comet is really zipping fast. And it hits that electrical alignment with Mars and Saturn, and bam, it's like a spark plug. Once again, the astronomical community calls it forward scattering. And this is not at all in a position for forward scattering because the Earth is not in alignment with this. And it, by the way, it was at, once again, the orbit of Mercury. So around a couple tenths of an AU from the Sun. So this is crossing the solar system all the way from Mercury past Mars and all the way out to Saturn. So it's not a big surprise that this was a big comet. It was called the Great Comet of 1976. But once again, if you know what to look for, then you can find the real explanation for why this comet exploded into brightness. And you don't have to look far, and you can do this for everyone. Okay, here we go. Comet Bradfield, C1980Y1 is the designation comet. And like Comet West, is crossing exactly on the orbit of Mercury. So this is also an indicator, and Mercury definitely has some comet activity that's going on all the time. So the tail drag definitely influences its orbit, and that is the planet Mercury, which is more like a comet sometimes than a planet. Okay, so very interesting, and this, by the way, resulted, this study of these various comets, which were daylight bright comets. The reason I took a look at these, and as I said, I took the information, the orbital data, what's called the ephemeris, and I put it into a simulator, and I looked at exactly what was going on, looking for those electrical connections in a comet. In other words, is coming into the solar system, all of a sudden it electrically aligns. That's different than a visual alignment. It electrically aligns. In other words, it's the Sun, the comet, and other celestial bodies. And in all cases, you find that it is there. And the astronomical community, like I say, they don't know what to look for. So they find some other bogus explanation, and that sticks for literally 100 years. And there's other explanations of, like, the Oort cloud, for example, something that nobody could ever discover. Nobody could ever measure. This is allegedly where comets, dirty snowballs form out in the far out reaches of the solar system, way out beyond Pluto. You know, the Oort cloud is so far away, but the thing is, it's never been detected, never been measured, never could be measured, because if you sent a spacecraft out in one direction, if you ever got there, and if you ever could signal information back, there would only be one spot of this giant, giant donut-shaped alleged ring of comets that is out there. And so literally, it has never been verified. Nobody's ever seen it. Nobody could ever see it. With all of the best equipment, with the James Webb telescope, the best equipment on the planet, nobody would ever be able to detect the Oort cloud, but it's been in every textbook of astronomy since textbooks were written on astronomy. An absolutely preposterous theoretical construct necessary to bolster up, to shore up their dirty snowball comet model concept, which, by the way, wasn't invented by Fred Whipple. It was really reconstituted by him. It really came about back in the days of Edmund Halley and Kepler, when they first realized that comets are out there and not in our atmosphere, because according to Aristotelian physics, the great Greek philosopher, and of course he was working with the data that he had available, but they thought that comets were fire up in the sky. That's the only thing they could imagine. They had the concept of air down, in other words, you breathe air, but you couldn't see it. And so they had that down. They had some certain basic understanding of things, but they thought that comets were fire in the atmosphere. That's what they believed, and that the atmosphere, they really didn't know. They didn't know about the solar wind. They didn't know about charged particles. They didn't know about plasma. They didn't know really a lot about how the solar system worked. So at any rate, at this point, what I want to do is go into a little bit of comet physics. And the reason I want to do this is because this comet is coming close to Venus, but how close relative to the size of the comet? And that's a question. And of course, we begin with the stunning lack of information on the size of the nucleus of this comet. And we could get a potential handle on this because as Venus interacts with the comet, it's going to change the comet's orbit. And I think they've already calculated that into the idea that this comet came from a closed orbit and it's going to leave on an open orbit that'll never come back. So surely that accounts for the fact that it's coming close to Venus. But there's never, when push comes to shove, or what are some of the other expressions? Of course, according to Newtonian physics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So the comet being relatively small, we assume, because we don't know, NASA's never said anything, and of course they measure the size of these nuclei. They can with radar, with radio telescope information, that's easy to do. So we know they've done it. They're just not announcing it. But typically, it would be relatively small compared to Venus, so the perturbation in Venus orbit would be quite small, possibly not even measurable. But we don't know. We don't know because nobody has told us the size of this nucleus. And, of course, the density, no one really knows either. Could this be from the core of a neutron star where something 10 miles across would weigh the same as planet Earth? We don't know. Because NASA is not, they have the ability to take this data, but they're not. Okay, so in terms of, let's just say, for example, that the nucleus of this comet is like the size of Halley's Comet, 7 to 10 miles across, something like that, just a rough estimate of the size of the nucleus. And typically they're odd-shaped. They're not like a perfect little sphere like the planets. They're like odd-shaped. And so our assumption, based on really no information at all, is that this is the nucleus of this comet is relatively small. Okay, so it's going to come within 2.6 million miles. And so if it's 10 miles across physically, then that's just like a drop in the bucket. It's a small amount compared to the distance from the nucleus of the comet to the planet Venus. Okay, now let's talk about another physical feature, something we can see, and that is the coma. And so the comas can range up to, say, 50,000 to 100,000 miles across. And that's in a well-developed comet, so very possibly this comet could have that extent. And so that would fill up a gap of 100,000 miles. But the comet is going to be about 2.6 million miles away, certainly a lot farther. So how is this comet going to interact with Venus? Well, the answer is in a feature of the comet which is not visible, and that amounts to something called the Debye shield. It's a hydrogen atom, ionized atom shield that surrounds the nucleus of the comet because the nucleus is negatively charged. Actually, the nucleus is not negatively charged. It's the space sheath around the nucleus that is negatively charged. And so anyway, what happens is in a plasma, you develop what is called blocking or shielding. And this happens naturally where the positive ions form a sphere around the nucleus and form a shield. So outside of that shield, you would not know this thing is electrical. Because it's shielded. It's just like an atom. An atom has a proton or a series of protons. and in the nucleus, and then it has, say, an equal number of electrons around orbiting around. The overall electrical force is zero. Basically, it's neutral outside of, because the electrons are shielding the protons electrically. And that's the same situation with the comet nucleus, except that the nucleus is negative and the surrounding material is positively charged hydrogen ions is what it amounts to. And so this forms a shield. Now, this is the shield that extends way out there. This is the one that could cross the barrier, the open space distance to the planet Venus. Or since Venus is charged also, there's going to be some interaction here, so that even though their closest approach is 2.6 million miles, even though the coma, the gaseous surrounding of the coma, the nucleus of the comet, even though that's only about 50 to 100,000 miles, certainly not enough to bridge the gap between the comet nucleus and Venus. But then again, the orbit of this comet could be changing also, which is a possibility, bringing it even closer or maybe farther away. We don't know. We don't have this kind of data, although NASA certainly does. And the boys that you pay, the government-funded people, but they're not telling you. Their mom is a church mouse about this whole comet and everything about this comet, because I think they've been given the order from higher up that, in fact, just ignore this comet. Don't publicize it. Even though it's a Christmas comet, it'll be there. Everybody will be able to see it. Don't publicize it is the word coming from the higher ups in the what you might call the intel community. Basically the CIA, which operates NASA and tells it what it can and cannot say. Remember that the NASA scientists cannot just go up to a newspaper or a media outlet or a microphone and say, oh, by the way, this is really something that's happening with this comet. No, they are under strict lock and key. They cannot make a public announcement of any kind until it's okayed by their the higher ups. And so the news media flow to you, the public, is very, very controlled. And it's the same group of people to make sure that the science information being released from NASA to the public is homogenized, blended, and sterilized for your consumption. Okay, so at any rate, it's this Debye shielding hydrogen cloud that surrounds the comet nucleus, and this goes way out there. This is probably a good 2.6 million miles or potentially more, but you can't see it. It's not something you would see. The only way you'd really detect this is if you had localized spacecraft. And maybe you would see part of it from other types of interaction. But once this region starts connecting with Venus, then you have current flow. Then you have material flow, the tail, etc., because Venus is relatively neutral electrically. And so they're going to have an interaction. There's going to be a charge exchange, and when that occurs, then you're going to have a material exchange of rarefied atoms, rarefied gases, atomic forms, molecular forms of gases that's going to flow between the comet and Venus. And that's when the electrical discharges will light it up like a light bulb, like a neon bulb. If you want to know how a neon bulb works, or any type of vacuum bulb that can be used in a laboratory or in a doctor's office or for specialized purposes, or just like a neon light bulb that lights up the night, you have a glass tube, basically a rarefied atmosphere of that, say, neon, and when you send a high voltage current through it, a high voltage from the ends of the tube, when you send that high voltage through the tube, and a very low current actually, but it lights it up like a light bulb. And so that literally is how a neon light or other types of phosphorescent lights, etc., that's how they work. And so you have the same condition in outer space. You have a rarefied gas, you have electrical discharge, and you should be able to see that. Certainly with good equipment, you would be able to see that. And if it's not very much, you might not be able to see it from Earth, certainly not with the naked eye. But it'd be hopeful that everybody could without having specialized equipment. Then that's when, by the way, everybody is going to say if they see that, and not everybody has telescopes or binoculars, etc., or the ability to go out at that time of night and go comet searching. But enough people do that they're going to dedicate a little bit of time to this. And hopefully we'll get some good photographs, some good data back of the comet interacting with Venus electrically. And gravitationally, Venus will have its orbit perturbed. The comet will have its orbit perturbed. And we have some milestones, for example, at Venus. Venus is due for January 6th, and we have the exact time and everything. Yeah, so we have it down to the minute, the inferior conjunction of Venus, the planet, with planet Earth. And so if that's off by a little bit, it might be our first indication that Venus has a new orbit and that the encounter with this comet Leonard was gravitationally significant. And the reason that we can't predict that is because there's no data to indicate the mass or size of this nucleus. And so anyway, that's the subject for upcoming weeks. Okay, so now the tail of the comet, I was saying the physical size of the nucleus might be just make an estimate of 10 miles long. And the tail, now this is something that is the discharge of the solar capacitor, is the tail could be 100 million miles long, or the equivalent of the Sun-Earth distance. So this thing physically is very small, but electrically it's very big. And so the tail of the comet is fairly long. It could be as much as potentially 1 million miles long. And there again, this thing is coming very close to Venus. And once those things connect, once the plasma sheaths surrounding the comet and then the planet connect, then it's very likely, the physics is there, that Venus would turn into a comet also and potentially lose atmosphere because of the comet sucking atmosphere off the planet. Or it could turn around where Venus, the planet turned comet, could actually take a lot of the materials from the comet itself. And so it would be an exchange in that direction. And there's rationale for believing that Venus will be the winner in a tug of war over atmosphere. Because once the electrical connection is made, it's a gravitational thing, because the electric shroud is equally distributed amongst the two, and then it's just a matter of which gravitational field wins, and in that case, Venus would be the winner. We know that's what happened with Mars. When Venus came by Mars, it pulled the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars because it had a higher surface gravity. Very simple. And then when it came by Earth, hundreds of years later, on two different encounters, Earth was the one that pulled off of the comet because Earth's gravitational surface gravity was higher than that of the comet, which even the planet Venus today is smaller than Earth and has lower surface gravity. So anyway, all of this is described in my books and in great detail. So the question remains, as we work up until tomorrow night, remember tomorrow night, make sure you're out there to take a look at this. Even if it's difficult to see, these will be so close that they will literally be one in the universe. And then with one tail, it'll be very interesting to see. But then it's the next night, it's the 18th, when the comet starts pulling up and away from Venus, that I'm hoping that Venus can maintain that charge long enough to develop a comet tail. And that's when we'll start to really see Venus. If it develops a comet tail, that's when you'll really be able to see it as an individual. Because tonight, tomorrow night, The comet and Venus are so close that you won't be able to differentiate between the two. You if they connect early enough, you might be able to see a specific separate tail for Venus, because we actually did with the comet Hale-Bopp, where it had a companion. The companion had its own tail, and Venus, I'm sorry, the companion of Hale-Bopp had its own comet tail, and so did Hale-Bopp. So you saw this comet basically orbiting the bigger comet, and that's the same thing that happened when the New Horizons, I believe it was called, spacecraft approached Pluto. And from a distance, you could see Charon, the moon, with its own comet tail. You could see Pluto with its own comet tail, and Charon orbiting Pluto, although the orbital period was not as short as with the companion of Hale-Bopp. And so anyway, the end result was, though, that you could see the dual comet tail. That was my point. And then, of course, when they got really close to Pluto, which is acting as a comet, it's a Kuiper Belt object, and all these, there's a tremendous amount of cometary discharge activity going on out in the Kuiper Belt, building up planets over a long period of time out there. But the point is that you could see, when they got close to Pluto and were able to see at nose, like literally spitting distance, as I call it, nose to nose with Pluto, you could see the vapors forming in the upper atmosphere and falling down in the form of snow. It was a nitrogen-hydrogen compound snow, but crystallizing and falling down and building up the surface layers on Pluto. So it was growing, and that is the whole point of tail drag, is that the planet is accumulating mass that was stationary, and Pluto is moving through that, and so there once again is a momentum exchange there between the material coming in and Pluto, which is moving, and so that reduces the orbit, reduces the energy in the orbit, so it slowly spirals inward. And so anyway, that is the crux of the issue with tail drag. And this would be very interesting too, to see if for whatever reason this comet might come a little bit closer to Venus and do something that nobody is expecting. So there's a lot of variation here in what could happen in the gravitational sense. So you have the electrical interaction between the comet and Venus. You have the material exchange between the comet and Venus. You have potential magnetic interactions, which are real because there are electric and current involved. You have the issue that Venus might become a comet or develop a sunward spike, and the comet develop a sunward spike, and we are broadside. So if you do see that activity, it in fact will be sunward. It's not the artificial Aaron Rowland, it was only an optical illusion type of explanation. And then the other issue is that Venus could maintain a comet tail for a number of hours, days, weeks. We don't know. This is the last time this happened, was over 4,000 years ago, and we don't have a lot of really detailed records. We just have the fact that Mars was a blue planet, and the next day it was not. It lost its oceans and atmosphere. The atmosphere is required to hold it in place, to give it the surface pressure that keeps the water in place. And so Mars lost it. Mars lost its atmosphere and ocean to the comet Venus, which is now a planet. And anyway, I find this interesting, because if somebody is listening right now, say from traditional astronomy background, they're going, what is this guy talking about? You know, losing its atmosphere and Mars, etc. Well, we know Mars lost its atmosphere, and what I'm telling you is it lost it recently, within the last number of thousands of years, because the ancients saw it. The ancients saw Mars as a blue planet. But then again, if somebody is in that boat where they're listening and they don't understand this, then that proves one thing and one thing only, that you are a Tier 2 scientist. Because the Tier 1 scientists, the middle scientists, know exactly what I'm talking about. In fact, I have had them come out and talk to me, and they know exactly what I'm talking about, that the Dirty Snowball Comet model is not a valid model. It makes no sense. It's just garbage science meant to pawn off on the public, and the people in Tier 2 science are not savvy enough to break through that mold and understand that there's a whole layer of science above them. Okay, so at any rate, we're getting down to the point now where it's simply a matter of observation. So let me remind you that tomorrow night is the closest approach of Comet Leonard to the planet Venus. 10 lunar distances, about 2.6 million miles, extremely close. And so the comet should look as a separate entity, but here's what's going on visually, is that the comet itself will be behind Venus. So if they were side by side and more than, say, 50 or 70,000 miles apart, you would be able to see the comet as a distinct entity and the planet Venus as a distinct entity and a little dark space between them. But what's going to happen is during the closest approach, the comet will actually be behind the planet Venus from our perspective from planet Earth. And so it'll be behind Venus. And so if Venus is going comet, you may be able to see the Venus tail, or it may look like just part of the comet tail of the companion. But since the companion being the comet, I shouldn't call it a companion because a companion would imply that it's there permanently. But wouldn't that, and I brought this up too, wouldn't that be amazing if this were a terraforming project in which this was meant to become a moon of Venus? And that is not, I don't frankly believe that, but it gives you the idea of the kind of thing that could be done to help terraform a planet. And what's the advantage of having a moon? Well, with the moon, Venus would develop a magnetic field. It would have a protective magnetic field. And that's something that it would have for the rest of its existence. And just like our moon is a very essential part of our system, the Earth-Moon system, for life, because it's the magnetic field of Earth that protects us against the severe radiation coming from the sun. The upper atmosphere blocks a lot of it, but also the magnetic field of Earth blocks a lot of the particles and stores them in Van Allen belts, the high-energy particle belts that surround Earth. And so the magnetic field is very essential. Out there around 35,000 miles out to the sunward side, when the solar wind comes in, the electrons go one way, the protons go to the other. So it's one of the main sources for one of the electrical batteries that surrounds Earth, which Venus does not have. So Venus having a moon, which would give it a magnetic field, would get it going on the same path as Earth, is the entire point here. So a little bit of physics behind what we're observing here. Very exciting times. As I say, something that has not happened in the past 4,000 years, at least 4,000 years, which makes it almost bizarre. I mean, it's not even comical. It's bizarre that the news media is actually just blanking out any information on this at all. Okay, the last few minutes, I'm going to talk about the water filters. And here we are heading down the last, like a week before Christmas. We have these things in stock. We're shipping out the next day, the MR5 whole house water filter. Or if you'd like a sink filter, very high quality stainless steel products. And we have these in stock. So we're shipping from the warehouse that we ship to all of the states. We do not ship foreign. We don't have any more foreign sales. If you try and order something and have it shipped to a foreign country, the system will block it and won't let you pay for it even, because we just do not ship to foreign markets anymore. The MR5 is a whole house water filter. It filters the water at the point of entry into the house, so your hot and cold water is filtered, something that's extremely important. And right now they're on sale the sale is going to go away by the way, next week after Christmas, the 10% sale is going away, and the coupon code is going away December 31st, which is JMCC, to get another 10% off. The reason these are going off is because we have other programs coming in, advertising programs, and the sales are going to, let's just put it this way, go up. And so that'll put a lot more pressure on the ordering systems, our shipping systems and things like that. We have a very high capacity, but the point is that if you want to get it on sale, do it now. You get a 10% discount. It's approximately 10% off the normal, actually very good price compared to any, I wouldn't call them competitors. There are no competitors to the MR5. But 10% off our already low price, and then another 10% off with the coupon code JMCC and free shipping. Except Alaska and Hawaii, we're going to charge you a little bit extra shipping. But to the 48 states, free shipping. We ship out the next day. You get it. We help you, your plumber, install it. And you're set. You have clean water. And by the way, I heard a report, I haven't personally verified it, that they're putting graphene oxide in the water in the UK. And that's one of the main things they're trying to get into people is graphene oxide. It's something you do not want in your body, but in the UK they're putting it in the water system. And so the MR5 is your defense against putting chemicals, poisons, or other volatile organic chemicals, or graphene oxide, etc., in your water system. And if you have a well, a lot of times there are ground contamination, especially if you're in an agricultural area. You have the glyphosate, which is the Roundup chemical, very bad. You want to get that out of your water. And in the city, a lot of people don't know this, but when they put chlorine into your water, it forms about 7 or 8 subcategory acids that are in your water that are really bad for you. You have to get those out, and the MR5 removes those also. So anyway, just remember the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. That's with an S, plural, jmccwaterfilters.com. And then the other page is my standard page, the jmccanyscience.com page, abbreviated jmccsci.com. And so anyway, go out in the western sky, take a look at Venus and this comet Leonard approaching it from below. And make sure you're out there tomorrow night, because this could be the show of the century, or of the past 4 millennia, in fact. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.